And now a program that may or may not be coming to a TV station near you.
In a world of fiscal chaos, in a nation of flanged and insulated pipes, only one man can ensure the soundness of our economy and the smooth flow of our household sewage.
Joe the Plumber.
From the creators of The West Wing, Dirty Jobs, and Bob the Builder comes a new series that probes the depths of political intrigue, even as it plunges the hairball from the powder room throne. Joe the Plumber.
It's Joe.
Joe, Hank Paulson here. Look, we've got ourselves in a heck of a mess, and I'm hoping you can help us. Wall Street's going down the drain, credit's plugged up, and it looks like the $1 trillion bailout might not be enough. The economy's in the toilet. What can we do?
Have you tried using a snake?
Joe the Plumber. From the tip of his wrench to the back droop of his trousers, he's a small businessman who's not afraid to get his hands dirty.
Credit lines clogged? Ben Bernanke's bidet? I'm on it.
Joe the Plumber. It's the blockage, stupid.
Plumbing satire by Bruce Kluger and David Slavin with Rob Webb and Chuck Lukowitz. Scientists say they've discovered one reason why overweight people eat more than they need to and find it so hard to stop. Their report comes out tomorrow in the journal Science, and their research involves high-tech brain scans, fancy genetic tests, and some chocolate milkshakes. And we've got some milkshakes, too, in this story from NPR's Richard Knox.
You could say we're all addicted to food, but we all know some foods are more addictive than others, like the milkshakes that a worker is whipping up at Gifford's Ice Cream in downtown Washington.
Make sure you get all the ice cream all blended up.
Today, one of the customers, Yvitra Jordan, is rewarding herself with a sundae. Chocolate milkshakes also make her happy.
Warm and fuzzy, and, you know, I just feel good. I'm like, ooh, that was great.
There's very few things that excite the brain as much as chocolate.
Eric Stice of the Oregon Research Institute says chocolate is just the thing to investigate the brain's reward system, the circuits that light up when people eat or drink something tasty. And chocolate milkshakes are ideal. The yummy flavor can be squirted through a straw while volunteers' heads are clamped into an MRI scanner. Stice and his colleagues looked at how the brains of 77 young women responded to the milkshakes. Some women were lean, some obese, and some had a gene that makes them less sensitive to dopamine, a chemical central to the pleasure response. So they don't get as much pleasure out of food as others.
When obese individuals eat food, they seem to have a blunted response to this food. And if you're at genetic risk, this effect is amplified.
We're used to thinking that overweight people love to eat and get more pleasure out of rich treats like ice cream. The Oregon researchers say this notion is only half true.
If you look at the brain response to when people are about to get the milkshake, obese individuals show greater activation of reward circuitry, not less. So ironically, they expect more reward but seem to experience less.
Kent Berridge of the University of Michigan says the new research helps explain the biological difference between wanting and liking. By wanting, he means anticipating something delicious. Liking means the pleasure that comes from actually tasting it.
It's an exciting result. The wanting and the liking start to come apart. The wanting is up and the liking might be blunted. And it's very intriguing that the blunting might happen in some individuals with a particular gene.
As with other addictions, Stice thinks people overeat to compensate for the mismatch between the strong cravings they have and the reduced enjoyment they get. The best way to avoid this vicious cycle is to develop healthy eating habits before pleasure responses get blunted by overeating.
Don't get your body used to eating high-fat, high-sugar foods because it'll be really hard to stop.
It's best to do this when you're young, Stice says. If you're already obese, the new research may have other implications.
So if you're trying not to eat chocolate, eating just a little bit of chocolate every day is not going to be the way to go. It's better to stop eating chocolate and say, that's the healthy improvement I'm going to make to my diet. And after a month, maybe 6 weeks, your craving for chocolate will finally go down and stay down.
Yvitra Jordan ponders the new research over her sundae.
I think that a lot of times what you see and what you think may fill you up, you know, is not necessarily what your body really needs. I think medically, some people just can't get past it. I'm a mind over matter type of girl.
If the Oregon researchers are right, that's truer than she realizes. overeating has a lot to do with what's going on in the mind. Richard Knox, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. We're going to spend some time over the next 2 days looking at Barack Obama's experience in Chicago and how that time helped shape him as a politician. Chicago is known as the City of Big Shoulders, famous for its pugilistic politics. That's a point of tremendous pride, says Delmarie Cobb, a longtime Chicago political operative.
This is Chicago, and we always say there's a little bit of a gangster in everybody who's from Chicago.
But when Obama first stepped on the national stage in his run for the White House, he faced constant questions about his fortitude and his lack of experience in national politics. Is he tough enough? When attacked, will he cower? Or will he fight back and go for the jugular? So common were these questions that a popular New York Times columnist took to calling Obama Obambi. It's now widely believed that he toughened up in the course of a long nomination battle. But people in Chicago, like Delmarie Cobb, who knew Obama long before he became a political star, say he's always had that warrior instinct.
You know, I don't think he was naive by any means, and I think people are beginning to discover that there was nothing naive about him.
Case in point, his first election. It's a story that could well be called the political execution of Alice Palmer. Palmer was a friend and early mentor to Obama when he was working as a grassroots organizer after law school. She was a longtime and popular state senator on Chicago's South Side. In 1996, Palmer decided to make a run for Congress. Alan Dobry is a longtime political activist who lived in Palmer's district. He says Obama was the chosen successor.
Well, if you go to the U.S. Congress from being a state senator, who will replace you? Are we just going to have some machine thug step in? And she says, no, I have this fine young man named Barack Obama. He seemed to be more than acceptable replacement for Alice.
But Palmer lost in the primary for that congressional seat and decided that she wanted her old Senate seat after all. Her protege, Obama, would have to step aside. It was a test, a Darwinian dilemma. In order to fulfill his own ambitions, he would have to kill his friend's political career. Obama stood his ground and even went one step further. Using an aggressive procedural move, he challenged the signatures on Palmer's nominating petitions, and he even went beyond that. He challenged the petitions for all three of his opponents. Now, mind you, it's not unusual for politicians to muscle rivals off the ballot. Not in Chicago, explains longtime Chicago alderman Tony Preckwinkle.
It's what you do in Chicago. My view is, and since I've challenged people and challenged people off the ballot, my view is, you know, you're not ready for prime time if you can't get your petitions in order and file them according to the requirements of the law. And if you fail to do that, then, you know, that's your problem.
And there was a problem. It turned out all the opponents had faulty signatures. Back in that 96 race, Alan Dobry was one of the people trying to verify signatures for Obama's campaign.
And we looked at their petitions, and we saw that Alice, her petitions were circulated by people named Pookie, for instance, who circulated that. We know what that means. It means somebody got a bunch of kids from the local high school to circulate the petition, and they put down the name as Pookie.
Obama's maneuver worked. He knocked all of his opponents off the ballot. He cleared the field and sailed on to an easy victory in the heavily Democratic district. Obama arrived in Chicago as an outsider, a guy who was raised in Hawaii. The move against Palmer proved to Democratic Party insiders that just maybe he had what it took to survive in Chicago, says Laura Washington, a columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times, who's covered politics for almost three decades.
Chicago is a tough political town. Bare-knuckled, folks fight to get ahead. If you wanted to win and if you wanted to be perceived as a tough cookie, he'd have to do what it took. I think that election was what made his peers finally sit up and take notice. He was nobody until he knocked off Alice Palmer. And his peers, I think, secretly admired his ability to do that, even though some of those folks were supporters of Alice Palmer.
Even though Obama had earned his party's respect, he faced significant challenges. He still had to penetrate a political machine that usually required a hometown pedigree. He had no family connections, no neighborhood network. But he didn't know a lot about grassroots organizing, and as a student of Chicago politics, he picked up a key lesson. Politicians are as powerful as their patrons. Jerry Kelman knows this well. He hired Obama to come to Chicago and work as a community organizer. And over the years, he watched Obama build his network.
Barack is wonderful at finding mentors, but not mentors, not emotional mentors or mentors to advance his career, but mentors he can learn from. He's just hungry, and he'll attach himself to all kinds of people, not even people who necessarily have status, but anybody who can teach him something.
Notice that Kelman said Obama is wonderful at finding mentors. That's an important detail. Kelman and many others told us that Obama doesn't wait for people to take him under their wing. He's much more assertive, tracking down powerful fundraisers and people that could help him maneuver for key committee assignments in the state Senate.
Well, my first impression really of Brock, he was very intelligent but rather pushy at the time, you know.
That's Emil Jones, president of the Illinois Senate and one of the most powerful figures in Illinois politics. After winning his state Senate seat, Obama quickly pushed his way into Jones's good graces. And when Obama was contemplating a run for the U.S. Senate, he turned to Jones, using a combination of chutzpah and flattery.
He came to me and he said to me, he said, "You're the Senate president now, you have a lot of power." I said, "What kind of power do you think I have?" He said, "You have the power to make a United States senator." I said, "Oh, that sounds good and everything." I said, "I never even thought about it, which I hadn't." I said, "If I have that kind of power, do you know of anyone I can make?" And he said, "Me."
Now, this was a very gutsy move for a junior state senator, and a little history will help you understand why. Obama was ambitious, but he was far from a political star in Chicago's largely black South Side, a fact that had been made painfully obvious when Obama challenged incumbent Congressman Bobby Rush in the 2000 Democratic primary and lost badly. So here was a young politician who couldn't win a congressional seat in his own neighborhood asking one of the state's political kingmakers to back him for a statewide race. Furthermore, Obama wanted Jones to help him leapfrog over a line of more established and much more powerful politicians. Bold, huh? Well, it turns out that's exactly what happened. One reason, Jones knew that even though Obama had limited appeal in his district, he had wide appeal beyond Chicago's largely black South Side. And Jones offered this story to make his point. Back when Obama was running for his U.S. Senate seat, Jones was traveling with the candidate in southern Illinois, an area known for being white, rural, and conservative.
You know, I'm sitting across the table from this little old white lady. And she made the most profound statement. She said to me, "You know, I am 84 years old. I certainly hope I live long enough. This young man, speaking of Barack, is going to be president one day, and I want to be around to vote for him." That was her first time meeting him.
That underscores another important lesson Obama learned in Chicago, the importance of building multi-ethnic coalitions. Southside black politicians traditionally build bedrock black constituencies by standing up to the white establishment. Obama embraced it. He was eager to lock arms with white leaders in politics and business, says Chicago Sun-Times columnist Laura Washington.
When he was a state senator, he was raising money from folks outside his district, which was really unheard of at that time.
How do you get away with that? Because a lot of people view those sort of patrons and benefactors with great suspicion.
I think at the outset, because he started when he was a state senator, he was so far under the radar, no one was paying attention to him. He wasn't perceived as a threat to anyone.
In Obama's case, geography made a difference. His state Senate district was in Hyde Park, a multi-ethnic enclave in the heart of Chicago's Black Belt. Hyde Park is home to the University of Chicago and much of the city's black elite. Emil Jones knew those financial, intellectual, and social power centers all could help Obama launch a credible Senate bid.
There is this bubble of Hyde Park where things that aren't politically possible in other parts of the city are politically possible there.
Ben Calhoun is a political reporter with Chicago Public Radio.
You don't have to become a precinct captain. You don't have to look for an opportunity to run for state rep and then run for state senate and then maybe some, you know, decade down the line run for Congress or the U.S. Senate. He was able to just not do an end run, but just sort of go through the side door. He, you know, just sort of slipped around the normal ladder that Chicago politics requires people to slowly work their way up.
Hyde Park is an island of independence that seems to be always locked in battle with a Democratic machine that runs the city. Politicians from Hyde Park who dare to cozy up to that machine have a hard time rounding up re-election votes. Obama forged a new path. The more powerful he became, the more he embraced the machine. But very carefully, says Chicago reporter Ben Calhoun.
If you look at his relationship with machine politics in Chicago, you see a very careful and well-planned relationship. He made certain alliances. He made certain endorsements. He embraced people when he needed to. But at the end of the day, he also always maintained a certain buffer between regular machine politics. But he only did that by getting to know it and getting to know what that machine wanted and how it worked.
So he didn't get oil on his hands.
Exactly.
While we were in Chicago, we talked to many people who helped launch Obama's early career. They're proud of the Democratic nominee and pleased that they share a piece of history. But as to those lessons, how to be tough, how to work the system, how to survive, several people expressed a certain discomfort about how Obama used that Chicago education as his star continued to rise. Hyde Park political activist Alan Dobry.
I'm afraid he learned to go along. Or as a fellow I know, another committeeman, Bull Jive Taylor, used to say to me, Alan, why don't you go along? It'd be so much easier. Everything would be so much smoother. And I think Barack learned to go along. And that may get him elected president, but it doesn't make me happy.
Dobry is supporting Obama, but he's not exactly enthusiastic.
And so I will vote for him. But not, how shall I say it, full out, he's the second coming or something, but rather, that's the best we can do.
You expected more or something different?
Well, when he started out and we worked very hard for him, I thought we were getting something a little different.
Tomorrow we'll take a look at how Obama came to Chicago and how he used what he learned as a community organizer to launch his political career. Next week we'll look at how John McCain's background in Arizona and Washington has shaped who he is today. And as always, there's more stories about the candidates at npr.org. If you watched the debate, you heard one name over and over and over again, Joe the Plumber. It all started when Joe recently grilled Barack Obama at a campaign stop about how Obama's tax plan would affect him. At the debate, McCain claimed his tax proposal would be more favorable to Joe. Here's NPR's John Itzty to set the record straight about what each candidate's plans would do for the suddenly famous Ohio plumber.
Joe Wurzelbacher's 15 minutes of fame began this weekend when he buttonholed Senator Obama during the candidate's visit to his neighborhood near Toledo. The moment was captured on video and posted on YouTube.
Name's Joe Wurzelbacher.
Good to see you, Joe.
I'm getting ready to buy a company that makes $250,000 to $270,000 to $280,000 a year.
All right.
Your new tax plan is going to tax me more, isn't it?
Well, here's what's going to happen.
Senator Obama goes on to explain that if Joe buys the business and makes more than $250,000 a year, he would likely be taxed more under Obama's plan than under McCain's. For instance, if Joe were to make $270,000, his tax bill on that extra money would be $600 higher under Obama's plan than under McCain's. But there are a number of things to consider here, says Bill Gale, co-director of the Tax Policy Institute. First, when Joe tells Obama that the firm makes about $270,000 a year, it's not clear if that's the amount the firm earns before or after expenses. That's important, says Bill Gale.
Anything like rent or payments to workers or health insurance or supplies or investments, most small businesses can just deduct all of that.
So if the $270,000 the business earned was before expenses, it's likely Wurzelbacher's taxable income would quickly drop below $250,000. In that case, he'd do better under Obama's plan than with McCain's. In fact, Bill Gale says 98% of U.S. small businesses have taxable incomes under $250,000 and would get greater relief under Obama. Given his current salary, Joe Wurzelbacher shouldn't lose much sleep worrying about paying more taxes under Obama. He told Diane Sawyer on ABC's Good Morning America his income doesn't yet meet his aspirations.
To get straight here, you're not taking home $250,000 now, am I right?
No, not even close.
And Wurzelbacher admitted to the Associated Press he doesn't have a good plan to buy the plumbing business. He does work for Newell Plumbing and Heating in Toledo, which has a workforce that consists of owner Al Newell and him. Bill Gale says that actually Wurzelbacher is exactly the kind of worker that Barack Obama's trying to target with his tax plan.
It's kind of ironic that he went after Senator Obama, and it's even more ironic that Senator McCain used him as an example, because he's a perfect example of a taxpayer that will get a tax cut under Senator Obama and won't get a tax cut under Senator McCain.
But Wurzelbacher seems more concerned with money he might make in the future than his tax bill now. He told Diane Sawyer, people who earn more should be able to keep what they make.
Why should they be penalized for being successful? I mean, that's what it sounds like you're saying. That's wrong. I mean, because you're successful, you have to pay more than everybody else?
It's clear the man now known worldwide as Joe the Plumber doesn't like paying taxes at all. In fact, Bloomberg News reports today that he owes the state of Ohio $1,200 in back taxes. John Idstee, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The once miraculous Chinese economy is sputtering into slowdown, just as the world is counting on it to be a leading engine of growth. One sign of that slowdown is the struggling export sector, which has driven 30 years of double-digit growth rates. NPR's Louisa Lim got a firsthand look at those problems on a visit to Dongguan, a major manufacturing hub in the south of China.
Plastic Halloween gargoyle has pride of place in Mr. Su's office. His factory has been making such gadgets for the past 15 years, in its own small way contributing to China's economic miracle. But now that miracle seems to be going sour.
There's almost no profit. Raw materials have gone up, the cost of labor has gone up, inflation, everything's gone up except for the cost of the product.
His factory floor is uncharacteristically quiet. Normally 100 workers would be toiling here. Now he's only keeping on 20. Wages have gone up by around 20% in the past year because of a new labor law protecting Chinese workers. Raw materials are about 30% more expensive. And the Chinese currency has strengthened by about 9% over the year, meaning Chinese goods are getting pricier. For Mr. Su, who exports almost all his toys to the US, the financial turmoil is the last straw. It's unlikely Americans will have any spare cash to buy talking plastic gargoyles.
It's an economic tsunami. America's problems are washing over Asia and the whole world. It's like an economic world war.
So far, he's one of the luckier ones. Xinhua News Agency says nearly 80% of toy factories here in Guangdong Province have closed, along with almost half the shoe factories. According to one state-run newspaper, 37% of Dongguan businesses are losing money.
We've probably lost 40 to 45% of our turnover in the last 4 months. We have, for the first time in 10 years, no orders on the books for November and December.
Australian expat Chris Crossing owns a lighting factory in Dongguan. He says smaller businesses producing low-end goods are hurting badly, and the rash of bankruptcies will affect American consumers.
I believe the basic necessities that we all take for granted, the plastic clothes basket, the plastic pegs, the toothpicks that we all buy in our local supermarkets, they're going to be hard to find in the future because they're just not being produced in China because the companies are not there any longer.
Exports account for around a third of China's economic growth, so many economists are revising their China growth estimates down to single digits for almost the first time in 30 years. Austin Dolajal, who works for Skechers Shoes in China, says price tags for made-in-China goods will go up.
Yes, in the end, the consumer has to start paying a bit more. They can't go on forever getting these low prices and then lower and lower prices. That cycle has come towards an end.
Things are so bad in factories here, the local authorities have put together their own bailout package of $150 million for struggling businesses. But much of the problem was actually created by the central government in Beijing, rather than by the economic turmoil. Harley Sadin, the president of the American Chamber of Commerce in South China, says this slowdown was the result of deliberate action by the government.
The majority of this happened because of the changes in regulations last year, deliberately decided by the Chinese government in order to slow down the economy, one, and two, move away from the reprocessing, labor-intensive, environmentally unfriendly, and energy-intensive couple of companies. So certainly some companies have suffered as a result of that.
With unemployed workers crowding the local labor exchange, some economists believe the government was too aggressive in forcing change. State-run newspapers say 20 million Chinese workers have lost their jobs in the first half of this year. China's Communist Party has based its legitimacy on the promise of economic prosperity and rising living standards. It's kept that promise for three decades. But the perfect storm, created by its own reforms and the financial turmoil overseas, could mean trouble ahead. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Dongguan, China.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Michelle Norris. All this week, we've been profiling some of the most groundbreaking presidential candidates who never made it to the White House. Today, Senator Margaret Chase Smith. In 1964, Smith ran for the Republican presidential nomination and went all the way to the party's national convention. She was the first woman to reach those heights in a major political party. Our story comes from Joe Richman and Samara Freemark of Radio Diaries.
There are those who make the contention that no woman should ever dare to aspire to the White House, that this is a man's world, and that it should be kept that way.
My name is Janann Sherman, and I wrote the book No Place for a Woman, A Life of Senator Margaret Chase Smith.
My name is Merton Henry, and in 1964, I worked on the Margaret Chase Smith presidential campaign.
Margaret Chase Smith was born in a little town in central Maine called Skowhegan. Her mother struggled working in the shoe factory, working as a waitress and so forth. So it was not an easy life. And I think that was the basis for a lot of Margaret's ambition, that she didn't want to end up like her mother had. She had better ideas for herself.
She was the first woman ever elected to the Senate in her own right. She was very much a middle-of-the-road Republican who really followed her own instincts on things.
She definitely was seen by 1964 as a hawk.
It does not pay to play footsie with the communists.
She was probably the only woman in 1964 that had the stature to be a serious candidate for president.
It is contended that I should not run for president because the odds are too heavily against me for even the most remote chance of victory.
In January 1964, Margaret Chase Smith was scheduled to make a regular speech to the Women's Press Club.
Third, it is contended that as a woman, I would not have the physical stamina and strength to run. So because of these very impelling reasons against my running, I have decided that I shall.
So that was the opening shot.
Margaret. Senator Margaret Chase Smith of Maine, the first woman to announce a serious bid for the White House, who will enter the New Hampshire presidential primary on March 10th.
Oh, all out for Margaret, the senator from the wonderful state of Maine.
She campaigned in Illinois, she campaigned some in Oregon. She campaigned in small towns before Rotary clubs. She drove both places by car.
She would not accept campaign contributions, so she had no money, no poll workers, no buttons, no bumper stickers. Goldwater and Rockefeller, her opponents, were both millionaires. So I think she decided to take the moral high ground by saying, you don't have to be a millionaire to be president of the United States.
From Washington, D.C., Senator Margaret Chase Smith, Republican of Maine, will face the nation.
She tried to get people to pay attention to her record, what she had done of substance, not the fact that she was a woman. But, of course, she was constantly asked that. I mean, it's the very first thing that people see.
Senator Smith, not all countries have the same attitudes towards women as the United States. How do you think a woman president of the United States would make out in international conferences and those so-called nose-to-nose meetings?
Well, I would call your attention to Mr. Khrushchev's references to me through the years, when he called me an Amazon warmonger hiding behind a rose.
Well, how do you think you would make out in a kitchen confrontation with Mr. Khrushchev?
Well, I wouldn't care to estimate that. If it was making blueberry muffins, I probably would win.
We are well aware of that, Senator, from having sampled them.
She was always having to walk that tightrope between being tough enough to be commander-in-chief, to run a country, but still feminine enough and ladylike enough, because being feminine was absolutely essential. And so she tried to balance it the best way she knew how.
Leave it to the girl where there's the frill.
She was always meticulously dressed. She was very careful about her appearance and everything.
She would tell Time magazine that nothing clears her mind like vacuuming, or pose with a mixing bowl, or primping in a mirror. That was a favorite. Senator Smith had a campaign song called Leave It to the Girls.
We'll wear perfume and pearls, be diplomatic in pink curls.
The response from the press was not pretty. One of the pundits said that a woman could be president just as long as she didn't act like one. The press never treated her as if she had a realistic shot at it.
Good afternoon. This is the Republican National Convention at the Cow Palace in San Francisco. Before this day is out, the nominee of the Republican Party will have been determined.
I am now proud and honored to nominate the senior senator from the great Republican state of Maine, Senator Margaret Chase Smith.
You know, she knew at that point that she was not going to get the nomination, to say the least.
And there it is. Senator Barry Goldwater is the Republican Party's nominee for the presidency of the United States.
The standard is, if you're the loser, well, then you very graciously release your delegates to vote for other candidates. But Senator Smith never released them. And the total of the 27 votes that she got on the floor, she hung on to, denying Barry Goldwater the unanimous nomination. So she came in second.
The tumult and the shouting has died. Senator Margaret Chase Smith, the lady from Maine, has emerged from her precedent-breaking bid for the presidency with even greater stature and reputation. Let's get around to this. You made some history, lovely lady, in being the first woman ever nominated.
Yes, it's quite a satisfaction today to think about.
Why do it at all? People run because they want to prove a point. They run because they want to make a statement. They run because they've got an oversized ego or something. There are all sorts of reasons that people run for president, even though they may know they have little chance of winning. Her reason was to prove that a woman could be a serious presidential candidate. And she did. She proved it.
Will we see a woman elected president of the United States during our lifetime? Perhaps not so wild a dream. The world is changing rapidly. Politics change with it. Many of the once impossible things have happened. Time alone will tell if a woman will someday break the tradition that only men can hold that office.
Our series Contenders is produced by Joe Richman and Samara Freemark of Radio Diaries, with help from Posey Gruner and Deborah George. Tomorrow, our final contender, Shirley Chisholm.